You're listening to CNAS Live, a podcast version of events hosted by the Center for New American Security. It's been 1 week since Hamas launched a brutal attack on Israel, targeting civilians and killing an estimated 1,300 people. Reeling from this loss of life, Israel once again finds itself at war and posturing for an operation the scale of which is beyond any it has launched in recent decades. What effects will this have on security and stability in the Middle East? And what will be the United States' response to support their regional ally? To answer these questions and more, CNAS hosted a discussion on October 12th with Danny Cinchernowitz, Research Fellow of the Institute for National Security Studies, Jonathan Lord, Senior Fellow and Director of the Middle East Security Program at CNAS, and Carrie Cordero, Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at CNAS. The conversation was moderated by Richard Fontaine, Chief Executive Officer of CNAS. You can see all past and upcoming events at cnas.org/events. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this CNAS event examining Saturday's shocking terrorist attacks on Israel and the war that is now taking place. I'm Richard Fontaine. I'm CEO of the Center for New American Security. Thanks to everybody for joining us. Some have compared what happened on Saturday to the Yom Kippur surprise attacks in 1973. Others, I think aptly, have called this Israel's 9/11. And some have seen in the massacres of civilians the worst of pogroms in the past. But what's clear is that the attack amounted to an extraordinary trauma and departure point for Israel's security approach. Attacks in the Gaza Strip are ongoing as we speak. The United States has offered assistance to Israel. A U.S. aircraft carrier has been dispatched to the region. The Secretary of State is in the region today. And as the war goes on, worries about violence on other fronts, especially the Lebanese border, endure. So to examine the current state of affairs and what this means for security choices going forward and the role of the United States and the role of Israel, we have with us top experts. Jonathan Lord is Senior Fellow and Director of the Middle East Security Program here at CNAS. Prior to serving at CNAS, Jonathan was a professional staff member on the House Armed Services Committee, where he managed the CENTCOM and Middle East defense portfolio. He has a long history and record of service at the Department of Defense in the region itself and on security assistance issues and other things. Carrie Cordero is the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow and General Counsel at CNAS. She spent the first part of her career in public service, including as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, Senior Associate General Counsel at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and Attorney Advisor at the U.S. Department of Justice, and been involved in a number of issues and cases related to intelligence and counterterrorism. We hope to be joined shortly here by Danny Cinchernowitz, who is a research fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies in Israel. We've been having a few technical difficulties connecting with him in Israel. But actually, it looks like he has just appeared on the screen. Danny, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great. So thank you
for joining. Finally.
I was just introducing you. So Danny has served for 25 years in a variety of command position units in Israel's defense intelligence, including as head of the Iran branch and the Research and Analysis Division in the Israeli Defense Intelligence, and as the division's representative in the United States. And as I mentioned, he's a research fellow now at INSS in Israel. So thank you all for joining us. Danny, great to have you connected. Danny, if I might, maybe I could call on you to just give us 2 minutes on what the latest is on the ground and sort of what you're seeing and hearing about the situation.
Yeah, well, again, thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you specifically, Jonathan, for your kind gesture in that regard. I think it's extremely important because actually we're facing unprecedented events. Just on a personal note, I can tell you that 6 o'clock, half past 6 Saturday morning, I live in Rehovot. It's about 50 kilometers from Gaza Strip, and my wife woke me up. There is an alarm going on, and I tried to think who we killed. Did we try to assassinate someone? But it took me some time to understand that actually what we're facing is totally different. And actually, we faced with unprecedented attack by Hamas. I think that a lot of details already came out, how they succeeded in bypassing the obstacles that we built, and they, how they tricked us from the intelligence side. And I think that in so many ways, I think they had huge actually successes on the ground, unfortunately, that led to a staggering number of people that got killed, not only soldiers, but as you know, families, women, children, in all the villages and towns that are near the Gaza Strip. In that regard, this has led, of course, to, I think, unprecedented retaliation by the Israel Defense Forces, mainly now from the air, but maybe from the ground. And what we can hear from the leaders, the security practice commanders, but also from our political leaders, that actually Israel is aiming for eradicating Hamas. So I think in that regard, if it actually is the case, so we'll probably see some sort of land maneuver. We continue seeing Israel actually trying to dismantle Hamas capabilities from the air. And with this kind of pincer movement from the air and from the ground, try to reach this kind of a target. Of course, there are a lot of questions regarding what will happen in the day after the Gaza Strip. But I think first thing is Israel is trying to make sure that Hamas won't be an address, political nor military, in the day after this operation. On the northern side, there is, of course, tension between us and Hezbollah. Actually, what we see, we mainly see activities of the Palestinian terror movements, Hamas and the PIJ, launching rockets from Syria and Lebanon, but also try to penetrate to the state of Israel. And that caused, unfortunately, to the deaths of some soldiers, three soldiers, actually, 2 days ago. In our retaliation, we killed Hezbollah operatives, and retaliation to that, as Hezbollah wants probably to preserve what we call the deterrence or the law of the game, they actually attacked again and killed another soldier yesterday with ATGM. So the bottom thing, we'll probably have a lot of time to discuss about what this means to the future of the region and what will happen in days and weeks to come. But the bottom line is that we are just started. The campaign just started. It will take time. And if the government is really want, and I think that they have no choice but to eradicate Hamas, it will take time. It will have to include also land forces. We don't know where, how, it depends on the army, but it probably have to include in that. And in our northern side, again, my sense is, and a lot of commentators talked about that in previous days in Israel, I don't think that each side wants to open a second front. But it remains to be seen. Things are developing rapidly. And the fact that we have friction, but unprecedented friction with Hezbollah, we have to say, it's been a long time since we had this kind of friction with Hezbollah on the Lebanese border. Then even if we are right and no either side doesn't want to open a front, I don't think it's at the end of the day, it might, we find ourselves in the northern front because of the friction, the high friction that we have with Hezbollah right now. So, things are really unprecedented in so many ways. It will take a lot of time. Of course, I won't even open what it means for the implication on the Israeli society, the relations between the society and the Israeli army. We actually, it wasn't the collapse of only the operational side or collapse of the intelligence. It was the collapse of our concept, our security concept. I mean, Gaza Strip, but probably not in the Gaza Strip. And this is something that we'll have to rebuild, rethink. But I think even the most important thing is the relations between the Israeli public and the army. This is something that I can't even describe what's going on now in Israel. And of course, everybody supports the army. We're all serving in the army. But there's a lot of criticism on the army and how reacted in the first hours of the slaughter, especially the slaughter in the villages and towns near Gaza Strip. So this is something that will escort us into the future. But first thing first, we have to win the war. We have to reshape our relations with Gaza Strip. We have to rethink how we're going to build that. We have to think what will happen in our northern front and making sure that we succeed in our what we're trying to do. But one thing I have to say, that something about the U.S. administration. I think people in Israel are so appreciative of what the U.S. did for us, especially the U.S. president. You know, at the end of the day, there is a lot of question. You know, what are the true meaning behind what we're seeing right now? Because it's actually can say that we need our friends to defend the state of Israel. We're not strong independently, and a lot of other things. But I think first and foremost, we see, and it's a true indication for the relations between the state of Israel, and the U.S. And I think that in that regard, this is something that it won't be forgotten. We are probably in one of the worst days of the Israeli history, I think even more than Yom Kippur War. And at the end of the day, the first country that came to our rescue in so many ways, not only by sending the force here, that's extremely important, we'll probably discuss about Iran and things like that, but even more than that, the help, the moral help, the things that being said by the administration, especially the president, it has a huge effect in Israel, and it was extremely important to mention that. So that, in a nutshell, the current situation here in Israel.
Great, thank you. I should say that we're going to take questions from the audience if there are questions. I'll be asking our speakers my own questions as well. So if you have them, you can put them in the chat box, or you can, I don't know if we say tweet or X now, but whatever the verb is for that, you can tweet at hashtag CNES2023, and we'll try to get to as many as we can. Jonathan, maybe I can go to you. So Danny talked about the need to win the war. What is, in your mind, as you've looked at this region and for a long time, what does winning the war look like, and what would it require?
Well, I think the goalposts for that have certainly changed in the current context. Previously, when Israel and Hamas would have these exchanges, the rhetoric was that Hamas needs to pay a price to be deterred again. And initially, those are the types of comments we saw out of Prime Minister Netanyahu. But I think as we assessed fairly early on, the Israeli public is going to demand more than what has been asked in the past, and that includes basically the disassembly or eradication of Hamas's ability to project terror from Gaza. To do that would likely require a full-on ground invasion into the Gaza Strip, which is a highly dense urban environment of 3.2 million Palestinians, and a prolonged counterinsurgency campaign to attempt to root out Hamas's control. That is going to be incredibly costly in men and material, and is very challenging to accomplish. I mean, there's no great guarantee of success. The U.S. has had a long history of counterinsurgency campaigns with, at the very best, checkered success. The challenge here is enormous. Israel will certainly have its work cut out for them if this is, in fact, the strategic objective.
Carrie, let me pull you in, and maybe we can go back and talk just for a moment about the attack itself and this kind of sadistic ISIS-like violence against civilians who are literally, you know, asleep or in their homes or in their cars or at a rave or something like that. And then this phenomenon of, you know, bringing cameramen or videoing this and then putting this out on social media. I mean, you've looked at this interplay of social media, new communications technologies, and, you know, graphic violence as a terrorist tactic. I mean, what do you make of Hamas's use of this in a way that they have previously not done?
Yeah, just to focus on the attack itself, for a minute, I think one of the aspects we've seen emerge over the last few days is trying to provide sort of a collective global and then also American frame of reference for how do we even understand what Israel has experienced in the last few days since Saturday and in the attack itself. And so I think that's why the 9/11 example so quickly came to the fore, because just in terms of at the beginning, the numbers of individuals, the numbers of Israelis who were killed, we were searching for, you know, how can Americans relate to this at all? And so the experience that the country experienced on 9/11, just this tremendous, terrible, terrible, historic terrorist attack, is sort of the original frame of reference. But when we think about the actual savagery that was perpetrated at places like the Kfar Azak kibbutz, just the massacre that occurred, when I think back over the last 20 years, the frame of reference that really comes to mind is Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and the savagery that he promulgated, engaged in, and then that led to the furtherance development of ISIS. And so it's that with the, you know, for those in of our viewers who need a refresher on that. So he was Al-Qaeda affiliated, but then established his foothold in northern Iraq and was responsible for just a savage beheading of an American contractor. His activities were so brutal, and the nature of then what became that sect of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which then became ISIS, was even different from other terrorist activity. And so if we think about it in that context and the massacre that occurred, that is the Hamas that Israel is going to have to deal with now and have to eliminate as a terrorist organization. And to the extent that there are now over 25 Americans who have died, I think we'll come back in our conversation to sort of how US policy is going to approach this. But the fact that there are over 25 Americans dead, an unknown number of Americans who may be part of the hostages who are were taken to Gaza, thinking about it in terms of an ISIS or a Zarqawi type of terrorist organization is really the framework that U.S. policymakers should be using.
Daniel, there's a question from Hiba in the audience about the regional and geopolitical implications, given that Hamas committed this terrorist attack with support from states like Iran and its proxies. So what is your understanding of the current understanding of Iran's role in all of this?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I've been asked a lot about that. We have to understand the relations between Iran and Hamas before we are answering this important question. Iran is supporting Hamas, funding Hamas, training Hamas, sending arms to Hamas. It's look at Hamas as its Palestinian branch of the, what we call the Iranian threat network. In that regard, there is coordination, they're working together, and Iran see that it's part of what we call a circle of fire that actually is circling Israel what Iran tried to do is actually to deter Israel from attacking Iran or attacking the other proxies in the region. That's one important thing. But we have to remember also that Hamas is a terrorist Palestinian organization that it has a lot of independence, especially in the Gaza Strip. So relating to that, there is a backing by Iran in that regard, but I don't think that tactically speaking, Hamas leaders, especially Mohammadev, the head of the military wing of Hamas in Gaza, need the Iranian approval in that regard. But so I think, of course, there was a backing of that, but tactically speaking, I don't think they need the approval or their help. As we see right now, Hamas in Gaza knew exactly what to do, unfortunately. And he read our activity in the border in a way that really unfortunately allowed him to have an unprecedented successes on the ground that led to the staggering numbers of the deaths that we encountered, unfortunately. Some of them, like being mentioned, in the ISIS-style activity. But I'm trying to look into the future. And there are a couple of questions regarding Iran and Hamas. I think, you know, surprisingly, returning back to what Mohammadev said in the first couple of minutes after the attack, what Hamas is expecting right now is not only fighting in Gaza. They're expecting a fighting also in the West Bank. Also, the Arab Israelis are expecting them to rise. They're expecting other fronts to be open. And this didn't happen until now. Now, again, I'm not saying that Hamas, of course, has no success. It operationally, of course, it succeeded. But strategically, I'm not sure they're achieving what they wanted to achieve, because for now, we are able to focus on Gaza, and hopefully it will stay as it is, without other fronts. And now the real question is what Iran will do. And in this regard, I think that the what the U.S. president said is extremely important in so many ways. The fact that he's not, he didn't say only the word don't, but also push the carrier here to the, into the region, Ford. I think that those things are extremely important, because it will, hopefully it will allow Israel to focus on the Gaza issue, and Iran hopefully will be deterred in so many ways because of the U.S. presence in the region. So again, we have to remember that we are in an evolving situation. Things that were correct yesterday or today will not be correct in the future. We have to stay alert, eye to the ball, making sure that things that they are changing, we notice them. But for now, I think that we are managing to isolate the Gaza front. Yes, we have things in the northern wall, that I said, but I think for now they are controllable. And I think that we'll have to see what will happen into the near and far future. But this is how I see the picture right now. Again, Hamas and Iran, like I mentioned, they are close. They have close relations, but tactically, as I mentioned, I don't think that Hamas needed any approval from Iran to do what actually it did.
Danny, let me follow up with you on one thing, and just staying with the attack itself, and then we can start talking about what comes next and policy choices and so forth. But you suggested that at least part of the motivation for the attack was Hamas's belief that this would stir up a broader attack on other front. I mean, the articulated sort of causes belli, if you could call it that, that Hamas articulated was the desecration of Al-Aqsa. But if this took a year to prepare something, a year ago, you had a different government. You weren't having these in Israel. You weren't having these kind of raids on Al-Aqsa. Other people have speculated, well, this they're trying to be spoilers in the looming Saudi Israel normalization. But again, a year ago, they could not have possibly known that in October of 2023, there would be a looming Saudi-Israel normalization. So maybe those were contributing factors. But is your sort of bottom line assessment of the motivation behind this, the desire to have kind of an overall revolt against the Israelis?
Richard, I think it's a great question. And I think that it goes back to the basic, I think, misconception that we had regarding Hamas. We thought that Hamas is a jihadi Palestinian terrorist movement. We knew that. But we thought it prioritized the well-being of the of Gaza Strip population. We thought that we can work with the organization. We thought that first and foremost for him is making sure that he can control Gaza. It's something that he wanted to do from 2007 after the coup against the Palestinian Authority. And he prioritized that over other stuff, especially the jihadi identity of the organization. What we are seeing right now is actually the opposite. At the end of the day, you know, death was above Yehoshua Sinwar. We all thought Yehoshua Sinwar, he wants to have some sort of coexistence with Israel in so many ways. But now we understand that it's actually, it was death all along and Sinwar in so many ways, because they are a jihadi movement. And they started something that I think we can relate that to Gaza Strip, to the West Bank and Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. I'm not thinking that it's, I think it was in their calculus. But first and foremost, we have to understand that we cannot look at that in a Western way of thinking. And that's what we understand right now. We thought about, you know, pros and cons, that we can achieve, we can show them achievements and then, or threatening them, and they will change their behavior. At the end of the day, they prove one important thing. They had a jihadi movement that think first and foremost about the jihad. So yeah, there were contributing factors, like I mentioned. Normalization, I think, well, maybe people, maybe it was something in the background, I'm not saying not, but it's, I don't think it was the focus. The focus, first and foremost, is they really thought that their activity, as I see that from the words of Muhammad F, will cause other nations to gather. I don't think they thought that they will eradicate the state of Israel, but I think they thought they would create a new situation based on their jihadi activity. And that leads to, again, what Jonathan said. In the end of the day, if we are facing this kind of movement, we cannot return back to the old way of living with them in Gaza, meaning that we are interacting with them through the Egyptians, we are opening our crossings, they are pushing some sort of workers to work in Israel. those things are long gone, because if they are jihadi movement, we cannot work with them, not for mediator, not for nothing. They need to be eradicated. Yes, it will take time. Yes, it will cost a lot of lives, especially of soldiers. Unfortunately, I hope not, of course. But in the end of the day, we understood after the tragical event of the 7th of October that Hamas is actually a jihadi terrorist movement, that we have no ability to work with them other than eradicating them.
Jonathan, let me go to you. Leon, who put a question in the chat box, has what I call the tell me how this ends question. So if Israel successful in reaching its objective, eradicating Hamas, then what? Just to paraphrase a little bit here, someone's got to govern Hamas after, govern Gaza after Hamas's potential destruction as a governing and military force. So who does that, given the very strong Israeli disinclination since 2005, even since before 2005, to be an occupying force in Gaza? So what are your thoughts on that?
It's an excellent question, and there's no great answer. Hypothetically, if Israel is successful in eradicating Hamas in Gaza, it's not as if the Palestinian Authority is going to be able to just walk right back in and assume control. Hamas threw them out in 2007. They really haven't had a foothold in Gaza since. I think it's going to be very likely that the IDF is going to have to reestablish administration of Gaza for some time. I'm not sure actually if the Palestinian Authority in its current condition is in any capacity to be able to actually govern Gaza. It can barely control areas of the West Bank under its authority, according to the Oslo Accords at this point. Its leadership is old and ossified. There isn't a clear succession plan for Abu Mazen. The Palestinian Authority security forces can barely close a hot dog stand at this point. Hamas has been able to get footholds in the West Bank. And they really don't have the support of many Palestinians in the West Bank now either, due to the years of rampant corruption. So, you know, there's a real problem here when we talk about Palestinian governance generally. To think that that organization is going to be able to simply just revert back to the way things were before 2005, I don't think is a realistic goal at this point, without some consideration for how the Israelis can assist in rebuilding some sort of legitimate Palestinian authority, which has both the trust of the Palestinians and the trust of the Israeli government with some capacity to govern. But that's a long road ahead. And frankly, I'm not sure at this point the Israelis have actually given it much thought. I mean, if we think back to what life was like in the days following 9/11, with the trauma of that, the pain, the emotions, and the immediate need for action, I don't think there was a lot of thought going on about some of the opportunity costs of the U.S. global war on terror, the extension of how many years that would take, and everything that's brought us to this point today. I don't think the Israelis are actually there yet. I think they're very much focused, singularly minded, in fact, on defeating the threat that Hamas poses.
Danny, maybe just back to you for a second. I mean,
Richard, if
go ahead.
Yeah, just want to, if I may, just to continue what Jonathan said. What happened in 7th of October is actually also the collapse of the Israeli strategy towards the Gaza Strip. We thought that we can create some sort of gap of differentiation between the West Bank and Gaza, working in a way with Hamas. We knew that there won't be any peace, but we thought that, like I mentioned, the Qatari money will flow in and there will be a stability and things. Once in a while there is some sort of a campaign against us, so we have Iron Dome to protect. It's so important because now we're facing in a reality that we have to build a new strategy while we are fighting, and that will be very hard to do, like Jonathan said. Now, yes, the first stage is eradicating Hamas, but what next? And I think that the huge question regarding that, but I think that we are not there yet. We have to understand that the Israeli population is in a stage that we demand the eradication of Hamas. And I think first thing first, and I know that it's a huge question that need to be asked, but because we are caught in such a surprise, surprised, not only from the intelligence side, but also from the strategical side. And we didn't give that much thought, then we have to build that while we are fighting. It won't be easy. It will be very hard, but we'll have to. Doesn't want to stay in Gaza. But the question is, who will be in Gaza? This is something that we'll have to work. And I think it's not only Israel attitude or solution. I think we'll have to involve here the international community. We'll have to involve here the regional allies that Israel has. And maybe, again, passing authority, I agree with Jonathan, very weak, but maybe into the long run. But I agree that this is something that we have to work on.
Kerry, let me go to you. In a very shocking way, a little bit of this that we saw over the weekend is reminiscent of, I think, an age that many people thought we were done with, which is, you know, this vast terrorist violence against civilians in the Middle East. You know, we, the United States is supposed to be focusing on China and maybe Russia, Ukraine. Terrorism was supposed to have been more or less vanquished, although it may pop its head up here and there in some ungoverned parts of the world and all this other kind of stuff. And now we're right back to something that feels an awful lot like 9/11 all over again, all these years later. So the United States and its own counterterrorism policy and its intelligence policies has some looming questions on before Congress on Section 702 reauthorization, things like that. So what do you think this says to policymakers in the United States about the threat that terrorism poses going forward?
Well, here's the thing. If we look back just in the last year or two of statements that are made by the Secretary of Homeland Security, by the FBI director, by the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, what they all say when they testify before Congress or when they speak publicly is that the threat environment has evolved. It's more complex than it was maybe 20 years ago. We have more attention that on the domestic side that we need to pay to domestic terrorism. On the international side, we have foreign malign influence in our elections. China is taking a much more active, much more space up in our national security policy making. Cybersecurity, obviously, all those things. But that doesn't mean, and all of these national security leaders say this repeatedly, it doesn't mean that the international terrorism threat went away. It just means it's an additional thing that needs to continue to be dealt with. And so we still do have legal authorities, operational components, analytical components within the United States government that are meant to address those. Have they probably been recalibrated over the last few years to draw down less on international terrorism and devote to these other threats? Yes, but it doesn't mean that that entire legal framework and infrastructure is gone. So what does that mean now, now that we have this major attack, an entire new environment that policymakers both in the Middle East and here in the US need to be thinking about Hamas and international terrorism? What that means is that there's a few really specific things that Congress needs to do. First of all, we need a Speaker of the House, because if there's going to be aid packages, if there's going to be additional things that Congress needs to do and consider other national security intelligence related issues, we absolutely, it is a national security, I just want to take this opportunity to say, it is a national security imperative that the House of Representatives gets a speaker quickly. Second, you mentioned Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So one of the big questions, and I understand on the Israeli side, this is a question that will have to be answered later, but one of the big questions is what in the world went wrong on the intelligence side of the house that there was not adequate warning to protect Israeli citizens, as well as American and the other dual nationals of other countries, European countries, who were killed and injured and taken hostage in this attack. And so there was a big intelligence collection, intelligence sharing component to this that both the Israeli security establishment needs to look at, but also the US intelligence components need to look at. And a big piece of that is there is a law that expires at the end of the year. I'll just hover on it for, you know, 10 seconds here, but that's Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Recently, in the last several months, the administration has made lots of arguments why it's relevant to what we were thinking about as modern day threats, China, Ukraine, cybersecurity, fentanyl trafficking. However, its original catalyst was counterterrorism. And so it is essential that Congress reauthorize that. And then the third piece is thinking about, the U.S. needs to be thinking about this in terms of both our partnership with Israel as our close and continuing ally, but also in terms of American interests. There were Americans who were killed in this. There are Americans who are hostage. And so from an intelligence standpoint, we need to also be taking a harder look here in the U.S. to make sure that we are paying adequate intelligence collection attention to Hamas and related terrorist organizations that might have a foothold here.
Jonathan, there's a question from Ellen about the potential risks for Biden and for the United States in unilaterally backing Israel's strong use of force, including any risk of damage to U.S. relations with Arab leaders. And I think you could probably think about that potential both today and sort of extrapolating out as to what, you know, I think is going to be a very difficult and very bloody operation in Gaza that is going to also play out on some of the, you know, the screens and of the world, just as some of the atrocities have done. So how do you see that?
Well, I think there may be an interesting paradox here. Understanding that while the Saudis really weren't on the table a year ago when the planning had begun for this, the Abraham Accords were in full effect. In the course of just a couple of years since the signing of the Abraham Accords, UAE has become Israel's largest, 16th largest trading partner, free trade agreements with UAE, Bahrain. I mean, the tectonic plates under the Middle East had absolutely begun to move, and the writing was largely on the wall. Last year, I think the common refrain was Saudi normalization is coming, but we'll probably have to wait until King Salman's passing. Clearly, things moved faster than that. But ultimately, when we look at the region today, I think Gulf partners are looking at the quick, decisive response that the U.S. has provided Israel and are incredibly jealous. I think that's exactly the type of relationship that the Saudis, the Emiratis, others seek with the U.S. And therefore, I think as the U.S. continues to provide quick, responsive military support to Israel in its time of crisis, that will actually only work to really burnish the features and benefits of continued normalization, of working with the U.S., Israel, others to build regional security architecture where they can collectively bring their capacities to bear to neutralize the very threats that Iran and its proxies pose to the region. So as the U.S. comes in full force, I think it's a real demonstration to MBS of what could be achieved. You know, right now, I don't think there's going to be a lot of bandwidth, particularly on the Israeli side, to negotiate this. They're going to be very much focused on the threat at hand. I think there are other potential spoilers here. The Israelis should, you know, ultimately be mindful of civilian casualties. I think civilian casualties and images of Palestinians wounded and dead will absolutely put negative pressure on the process. I mean, there is still an Arab constituency on the street that is very sensitive to that. So the more that Israel can do to focus specifically on Hamas, and the more that the U.S. can do to support Israel in that end and provide Israel what it needs to be successful in its moment of crisis, I think actually could ultimately help facilitate and further catalyze normalization and regional security integration.
So there's another question, Jonathan, specifically on the implications for Israel-Saudi normalization. So your sort of net is that this could actually catalyze rather than forestall normalization for the reasons that you just described, because many people have predicted, you know, just in the past couple of days, potentially the opposite, given that this is going to be a bloody affair in Gaza, and it will make it more difficult for the Saudis as we get further from, you know, the massacres in Israel and more attention is focused on the war in Gaza. It will make it harder for the Saudis to normalize with Israel, given what is expected to be some popular you know, opposition to that. But it sounds like you think that the opposite, in fact, is the case.
No, I think if you take a look at what all of the Gulf partners seek from the U.S., it is the type of assurance that in their time of crisis, the U.S. will be there for them. That's exactly what the U.S. is doing now for Israel. Strategically, when they look at their own backyard, that is key to their success. UAE's tourism industry, Saudi Vision 2030, all of these massive initiatives are predicated on being able to invite capital investment, tourists, that these countries be safe, secure from the threats that Iran and its proxies present. And the answer to that is clearly demonstrable with what the U.S. has been doing with Israel. If you just go back to January of this year, the Juniper Oak exercise, where another U.S. aircraft carrier strike group was in the Eastern Mediterranean to work with the Israeli Defense Forces, they put on a display for both adversaries, friends, and those on the fence that is really unmatched in the history of military affairs, and certainly was unmatched in the U.S.-Israel security relationship historically. The U.S. forces and the IDF have demonstrated that they are interoperable in multiple domains: land, air, sea, cyber, space. That's unprecedented. That kind of cooperation, collaboration, and military capacity. There are very few militaries that can operate in a combined way, even in their own militaries. The fact that the U.S. can do it and the Israelis can do it among their own militaries and then with each other, show me, you know, another relationship between two countries that has that. I think you'd be hard pressed to do so. It's very clear to the Emiratis, to the Saudis, to others, what they stand to gain from working more closely with the U.S. and the Israelis. And while, of course, images of civilian casualties could publicly work against that, the strategic benefits are absolutely clear to everyone in the region.
Danny, is that your assessment as well?
Yeah, I think that we have to remember that nor the Saudis, nor the Egyptians, nor the Jordanians wants to have Hamas as ruler in Gaza Strip. Now, we have to make sure that we are focusing, like Jonathan said, in our campaign against Hamas and not against the civilians in Gaza. I think that's extremely important. I think if we are able to do that, and maybe we can find a way, moderate solution to who will control Gaza. I think that we have the same notion in that regard, but we have to be very smart in how we are working or while we are conducting our campaign. And I think the first and foremost is focusing, like I mentioned, on Hamas, making sure that we are eradicating it while preserving humanitarian aid to the population in the Gaza Strip.
Danny, there's a question from Michael about how long Israel expects the U.S. and Europe to remain in support of Israel and, in Michael's words, not go wobbly over Israel's morally justified mission. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's returned back to what I said in the previous question. I think that meant that in their conduct more, they're not like a movement, political movement for the Palestinian cause, but more like ISIS movement in the Gaza Strip. And in that regard, I think that we'll continue push forward until we eradicate the organization. I think that we are expecting to have this kind of a support from the U.S., from European countries, because this is, against who we're fighting. This is, we know what they did to us. And it's not about a revenge. It's really about making sure that in the short term, in the long term future, people can live safely in the Gaza Strip and the rest of Israel. And in that regard, this is something that we need to make sure that will happen after the war. But as I mentioned, we have to make sure that we are perceiving as those who are doing that and not fighting against Gaza Strip in general, and making sure that we are preserving humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip population. If we do that, I think that we're able to maintain the support of the international community and even working with the moderate Arab countries in that regard. If we perceive differently, I think it will be very hard, despite the atrocities, to maintain the support that we are getting now from the US and of course from the European and other countries in that regard.
Jonathan, so it looks like there's going to be a ground operation in Gaza. I guess we can't be sure about that, but it looks like the Israelis are preparing for such thing. We've got some historical evidence to draw on the 2006 operation in Lebanon, previous ground operations in the northern part of Gaza, other ground operations in places like Fallujah and Mosul that sort of demonstrate how difficult urban combat can be with dug-in forces. So what do you think the sort of challenges and the possibilities are here of what I believe would be an unprecedented scope for this kind of activity?
Gaza is a highly dense urban environment of 2.3 million people in a landmass about twice the size of Washington, D.C. As far as a counterinsurgency campaign goes, this is going to equal in difficulty anything we have seen, I think, thus far in modern military history. I mean, the fighting will be house to house, block to block, if in fact Israeli forces plan to go in and then clear territory of Hamas control. There are other challenges. I mean, based off of what has occurred thus far, it is unclear how good our U.S. or Israeli intelligence is about Hamas's current military capabilities. There have been reports that even just in the short time that Hamas infiltrators were in Israeli territory, they were able to emplace booby traps and IEDs at the locations where they committed their atrocities. So we can fully expect that's going to exist on Hamas's side of the line, to say nothing of the intense, completely constructed tunnel system and the rat lines that Hamas uses to move men and material through the territory itself and then across the border with Egypt. This is going to be incredibly difficult. The human element of this really can't be understated too. I mean, part of counterinsurgency is destroying the controlling threat, the insurgents, but also winning the population. As of right now, Israel's energy minister, Israel Katz, has said Gaza gets no energy until Israel gets its hostages back. That's going to very, very quickly, as already have, put the Palestinian people in Gaza into a situation of crisis. And it's going to be very difficult for the Israelis to win over Palestinians and try to separate them from the population if there isn't some focus paid to trying to, you know, quote unquote, win hearts and minds, as we used to say in the Iraqi theater. So there are many levels to this. It'll be incredibly complicated, incredibly costly in resources, in personnel and material, very risky and difficult under the best of circumstances. And these are far from the best of circumstances.
There's a question from Kiana about what the conflict means for Netanyahu's domestic popularity. Do you think the embarking on the war against Hamas will strengthen national unity or shift attitudes? Is this part of Bibi's calculus? So I don't know if any of you want to look into your political crystal ball and see, you know, if we sort of, obviously there's but it seems to be both a rally around the flag, there's a national unity government, a war cabinet, all of that for very obvious reasons. There also is already, you can see great searching and discontent and questioning about, you know, where was the government? How long did people have to wait? Why didn't we to be rescued? Why didn't we know about this and so forth? But any of you want to look in your crystal ball, if you sort of project forward and say, see how some of this nets out for the prime minister and Israeli domestic politics? I can see you all jumping at the.
I'm happy to take a swing
right,
at this.
Jonathan, let's go to you, and then after Danny has another one of those big sighs, maybe he can give us a couple of thoughts.
I'm told we're supposed to be bold here at CNAS, so I'm going to step into the brief. So first of all, I mean, if history is any precedent, in terms of strategic operational intelligence failures, this you know situation has been most often compared to the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Following 73, Israel had something called the Agranat Commission to determine how the Israeli military and its government could be caught off guard so completely by Egyptian and Syrian surprise attacks. I think it's highly likely that once the dust settles, if the dust settles, the Israelis are going to demand similar types of accountability from its government. I mean, clearly, there's some sort of intelligence failure to bear here. I mean, there's already been reported that through the course of efforts to bolster settlement expansion and settlement activity in the West Bank, Israeli Minister Bezalel Smotrich, a far-right member of Netanyahu's party, had repostured as much as 70% of the IDF forces in the Southern Command, the area with responsibility over Gaza, into the West Bank. I've seen that reported. I've heard that from multiple sources. Those are the kinds of decisions that Israelis are going to want to see some accountability for. So I think ultimately, yeah, there is going to be certainly a strategic reconsideration on the Israeli side of how it deals with Gaza, but also there's probably going to have to be some political accountability at the top, both on the military side and in the civilian government.
Well, Danny, the 73 war also broke the Labor Party's dominance that had existed since 48 and opened up political space for the Likud for the first time, really. I mean, is there the possibility of a reverse effect given the dominance of right-wing governments in Israel for quite a long time? And where is that? How do you see this?
Well, I always said that I have the fortune of analyzing Iran and the axis and not analyzing the Israeli politics. I think it's easier to work on that. But I think I can tell you again, it's also for my, you know, how I see things from my personal view and, you know, people that a lot of people are talking about now in Israel about what will happen in the future. I think that we have to remember that Israel embarked this campaign when we are in the worst domestic situation ever. We were so divided in so many ways because of the judicial reform or judicial revolution, depends how you call it. And those who were against Netanyahu government will not, at the end of this campaign, will say, oh, Netanyahu saved us, we support it. They will be against him regardless. That's one important thing. The other thing, I think that we have a unity government. Gantz and Eisenkot joined in, and I think it's extremely important to have seniors that have the right experience in our war cabinet, so I think that's extremely important. But I don't think it changed nothing regarding how they see Netanyahu and Netanyahu's government. I think that during the campaign itself, I don't see any dramatic political change in Israel. I think that the people here, including also, we have to remember, there was major problems in our army, and the army leaders, at the end of the day, will have to answer a lot of questions about how the army, what the army did, especially in the first hours of the attack, and even before that, how they missed the alert or things like that. But no one is calling to change their for their resignation right now. I think that for now, everybody will stay put. Gantz and Eisenkot hopefully will help Netanyahu make the right decisions. The day after the war, again, I said that Netanyahu will try stay as prime minister, saying that it's not his fault, and we can blame the professional military side of things that happened, but I don't see a reality in which the Israeli public will allow the current government to continue as it is in the day after the war. It's connected to what happened before the war, it's connected to the failure in the war. The failures were not only failures regarding the operational side, the intelligence side. All the conceptual framework of Netanyahu collapsed. He said, in his own words, we have to strengthen Hamas and to weaken the Palestinian Authority because we don't want to have a Palestinian state in our borders. He said that in 2019. So all this perception about the Palestinians collapsed, and even more than that, he thought that he can jump over the Palestinians, running into normalization with regional countries. And these events show that we cannot ignore the Palestinians. So the bottom line of things, we don't know. I forgot my crystal ball at home. But my sense is that there will be a dramatic political changes in Israel in the day after the war.
Okay, there's one last question I just want to get to before we break here. And this is from Francis, and it's about Russia. how will Russia be able to take advantage of the situation? Is it banking on the U.S. being diverted away from the Ukraine conflict? I actually have a view on this, but Carrie, I don't know if you have an opinion or an insight that you'd like to offer on this before I offer my own kind of editorial comment, given that I'm the moderator and we're about to wrap up here.
Sure. Well, so I think one quick response to that is that what Russia wants overall is for the world to be distracted and turn its eye away from its illegal war against Ukraine and the brutality that it has inflicted there. And so any crisis, conflict, distraction that exists in any part of the world is going to work towards Russia's advantage, which is why it is so critical that that joint statement came out between President Biden and European partners in particular, highlighting the strength behind their collective support for Israel, showing that these countries, ours and these European countries, are united in support for Israel. And it also happens to be that those are countries that are integrally involved in making sure that Ukraine can defend itself.
Yeah, so just to add a tiny bit to what I think sounds exactly right to me, I think, you know, the Russians can't win their war if by winning, well, they first meant toppling the government in Kiev and changing the regime, but they, even the more modest goals that they have of occupying and annexing Donetsk and Luhansk and just being able to live with that as Russian territories. I mean, they don't even occupy all of the areas that they theoretically have annexed. And they can't win like that. And so I think Putin keeps sort of hoping for a feather to fall from the sky that's going to save him and shake up the situation. So I think there was some hope in Moscow that the last midterm elections would somehow elect a Congress who'd be unwilling to continue to provide aid to the Ukrainians. That did not happen. I think there's some hope that, you know, if Donald Trump is reelected, that he would cut off the aid and then the Europeans can't do their part and somehow they're saved that way. And it would not surprise me at all if the Russian leadership thought, well, okay, now the Americans will be so focused on Israel and any munitions that they would be giving to the Ukrainians, they'll now give to the Israelis. And I think all of that is farcical. I think none of that is going to affect. And if anything, in the very near term, the likelihood of combining the Ukraine and Israel aid packages actually makes it more likely that aid to Ukraine will pass a house that had been not fully supportive of it than it was a week ago. And so I suspect that if the Russians are banking on the U.S. being diverted away from the Ukraine conflict by focusing on the Middle East, they are going to once again be sorely disappointed. But that's crystal ball too. So, you know, take it for what it's worth, I suppose. Thank you to everybody for joining us. Danny, especially thank you to you for coming in from Israel. And Jonathan and Carrie, thank you for your insights and comments. And we will be doing more as things develop. So we will see everyone next time, and just a final note of gratitude for everybody for joining us today. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CNES Live, a production of the Center for a New American Security. This episode was produced by Anna Peterson and Charles Horn, with design help from Melody Cook and Ren Rothback. Please rate and subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts.